This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Magpie Murders, a novel by Anthony Horowitz, performed by Samantha Bond and Alan Corduna.
Crouch End, London. A bottle of wine, a family-sized packet of nacho cheese-flavoured tortilla chips, and a jar of hot salsa dip. A packet of cigarettes on the side. I know. The rain hammering against the windows, and a book. What could have been lovelier? Magpie Murders was number 9 in the much-loved and world-best-selling Atticus Punt series. When I first opened it, on that wet August evening, it existed only as a typescript, and it would be my job to edit it before it was published. First, I intended to enjoy it. I remember going straight into the kitchen when I came in, plucking a few things out of the fridge and putting everything on a tray. I undressed, leaving my clothes where they fell. The whole flat was a tip anyway. I showered, dried, and put on a giant Maisie Mouse t-shirt that someone had given me at the Bologna Book Fair. It was too early to get into bed, but I was going to read the book lying on top of it, the sheets still crumpled and unmade from the night before. I don't always live like this, but my boyfriend had been away for 6 weeks, and while I was on my own, I deliberately allowed standards to slip. There's something quite comforting about mess, especially when there's no one else there to complain. Actually, I hate that word, boyfriend, especially when it's used to describe a 52-year-old twice-divorced man. The trouble is, the English language doesn't provide much in the way of an alternative. Andreas was not my partner. We didn't see each other regularly enough for that. My lover? My other half? Both made me wince for different reasons. He was from Crete. He taught ancient Greek at Westminster School, and he rented a flat in Maida Vale, not so far from me. We talked about moving in together, but we were afraid it would kill the relationship. So although I had a full wardrobe of his clothes, there were frequently times when I didn't have him. This was one of them. Andreas had flown home during the school holidays to be with his family, his parents, his widowed grandmother, his 2 teenage sons, and his ex-wife's brother all lived in the same house, in one of those complicated sort of arrangements that the Greeks seemed to enjoy. He wouldn't be back until Tuesday, the day before school began, and I wouldn't see him until the following weekend. So, there I was, on my own, in my Crouch End flat, which was spread over the basement and ground floor of a Victorian house in Clifton Road, about a 15-minute walk from Highgate Tube Station. It was probably the only sensible thing I ever bought. I liked living here. It was quiet and comfortable, and I shared the garden with a choreographer who lived on the first floor, but who was hardly ever in. I had far too many books, of course. Every inch of shelf space was taken. There were books on top of books. The shelves themselves were bending under the weight. I had converted the second bedroom into a study, although I tried not to work at home. Andreas used it more than I did when he was around. I opened the wine. I unscrewed the salsa. I lit a cigarette. I began to read the book, as you were about to. But before you do that, I have to warn you. This book changed my life. You may have read that before. I'm embarrassed to say that I splashed it on the cover of the first novel I ever commissioned, a very ordinary Second World War thriller. I can't even remember who said it, but the only way that book was going to change someone's life was if it fell on them. Is it ever actually true? I still remember reading the Bronte sisters as a very young girl and falling in love with their world, the melodrama, the wild landscapes, the gothic romance of it all. You might say that Jane Eyre steered me towards my career in publishing, which is a touch ironic in view of what happened. There are plenty of books that have touched me very deeply. Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go, McEwan's Atonement. I'm told a great many children suddenly found themselves in boarding school as a result of the Harry Potter phenomenon, and throughout history, there have been books that have had a profound effect on our attitudes. Lady Chatterley's Lover is one obvious example. 1984, another. But I'm not sure it actually matters what we read. Our lives continue along the straight lines that have been set out for us. Fiction merely allows us a glimpse of the alternative. Maybe that's one of the reasons we enjoy it. But Magpie Murders really did change everything for me. I no longer live in Crouch End. I no longer have my job. I've managed to lose a great many friends. That evening, as I reached out and turned the first page of the typescript, I had no idea of the journey I was about to begin. And quite frankly, I wish I'd never allowed myself to get pulled on board. It was all down to that bastard, Alan Conway. I hadn't liked him the day I'd met him, although the strange thing is that I'd always loved his books. As far as I'm concerned, you can't beat a good whodunit. The twists and turns, the clues and the red herrings, and then finally the satisfaction of having everything explained to you in a way that makes you kick yourself because you hadn't seen it from the start. That was what I was expecting when I began. But Magpie Murders wasn't like that. It wasn't like that at all. I hope I don't need to spell it out any more. Unlike me, you have been warned.
Magpie Murders, an Atticus Punt mystery, by Alan Conway, read by Alan Corduna. About the author. Alan Conway was born in Ipswich and educated first at Woodbridge School and then at the University of Leeds, where he gained a first in English literature. He later enrolled as a mature student at the University of East Anglia to study creative writing. He spent the next 6 years as a teacher before achieving his first success with Atticus Punt Investigates in 1995. The book spent 28 weeks in the Sunday Times bestseller list and won the Gold Dagger Award given by the Crime Writers Association for the best crime novel of the year. Since then, the Atticus Punt series has sold 18 million books worldwide, translated into 35 languages. In 2012, Alan Conway was awarded an MBE for services to literature. He has one child from a former marriage and lives in Framlingham in Suffolk. The Atticus Punt series. Atticus Punt Investigates. No Rest for the Wicked. Atticus Punt Takes the Case. Night Comes Calling. Atticus Punt's Christmas. Gin and Cyanide. Red Roses for Atticus. Atticus Punt Abroad. Praise for Atticus Punt. Everything you could want from a British whodunit. Stylish, clever, and unpredictable. The Independent. Watch out, Hercule Poirot. There's a smart little foreigner in town, and he's stepping into your shoes. The Daily Mail. I'm a fan of Atticus Punt. He takes us back to the golden age of crime fiction and reminds us where we all began. Ian Rankin. Sherlock Holmes, Lord Peter Wimsey, Father Brown, Philip Marlowe, Poirot. The truly great detectives can probably be numbered on the fingers of one hand. Well, with Atticus Punt, you may need an extra finger. Irish Independent. A great detective story needs a great detective, and Atticus Punt is a worthy addition to the fold. The Yorkshire Post. Germany has a new ambassador, and crime has its greatest detective. Der Tagesspiegel. Alan Conway is clearly channeling his inner Agatha Christie, and good luck to him. I loved it. Robert Harris. Half Greek, half German, but always 100% right. The name? It's Punt. Atticus Punt. The Daily Express. Soon to be a major BBC One television series. Part 1. Sorrow. Chapter 1. The 23rd of July, 1955. There was going to be a funeral. The two gravediggers, old Jeff Weaver and his son Adam, had been out at first light and everything was ready. A grave dug to the exact proportions, the earth neatly piled to one side. The church of St. Botolph's in Saxby-on-Avon had never looked lovelier. the morning sun glinting off the stained glass windows. The church dated back to the 12th century, although, of course, it had been rebuilt many times. The new grave was to the east, close to the ruins of the old chancel where the grass was allowed to grow wild, and daisies and dandelions sprouted around the broken arches. The village itself was quiet, the streets empty. The milkman had already made his deliveries and disappeared, the bottles rattling on the back of his van. The newspaper boys had done their rounds. This was a Saturday, so nobody would be going to work, and it was still too early for the homeowners to begin their weekend chores. At 9 o'clock, the village shop would open. The smell of bread, fresh out of the oven, was already seeping out of the baker's shop next door. Their first customers would be arriving soon. Once breakfast was over, a chorus of lawnmowers would start up. It was July, the busiest time of the year for Saxby-on-Avon's keen army of gardeners, and with the harvest fair just a month away, roses were already being pruned, marrows carefully measured. At 1:30, there was to be a cricket match on the village green. There would be an ice cream van, children playing, visitors having picnics in front of their cars. The tea shop would be open for business. A perfect English summer's afternoon. But not yet. It was as if the village was holding its breath in respectful silence, waiting for the coffin that was about to begin its journey from Bath. Even now, it was being loaded into the hearse, surrounded by its somber attendants, 5 men and a woman, all of them avoiding each other's eye, as if they were unsure where to look. 4 of the men were professional undertakers from the highly respected firm of Lanner and Crane. The company had existed since Victorian times, when it had been principally involved in carpentry and construction. At that time, coffins and funerals had been a sideline, almost an afterthought. But, perversely, it was this part of the business that had survived. Lanner and Crane no longer built homes, but their name had become a byword for respectful death. Today's event was very much the economy package. The hearse was an older model. There were to be no black horses or extravagant wreaths. The coffin itself, though handsomely finished, had been manufactured from what was, without question, inferior wood. A simple plaque, silver-plated rather than silver, carried the name of the deceased and the 2 essential dates. Mary Elizabeth Blakiston, the 5th of April 1887 to the 15th of July 1955. Her life had not been as long as it seemed, crossing 2 centuries as it did, but then it had been cut short quite unexpectedly. There had not even been enough money in Mary's funeral plan to cover the final costs. Not that it mattered, as the insurers would cover the difference, and she would have been glad to see that everything was proceeding according to her wishes. The hearse left exactly on time, setting out on the 8-mile journey as the minute hand reached 9:30. Continuing at an appropriately sedate pace, it would arrive at the church on the hour. If Lanner and Crane had had a slogan, it might well have been, "Never late." And although the 2 mourners travelling with the coffin might not have noticed it, the countryside had never looked lovelier, the fields on the other side of the low flint walls sloping down towards the River Avon, which would follow them all the way. In the cemetery at St. Botolph's, the 2 gravediggers examined their handiwork. There are many things to be said about a funeral, profound, reflective, philosophical, but Jeff Weaver got it right. As leaning on his spade and rolling a cigarette in between his grubby fingers, he turned to his son. "If you're going to die," he said, "you couldn't choose a better day." Chapter 2. Sitting at the kitchen table in the vicarage, the Reverend Robin Osborne was making the final adjustments to his sermon. There were 6 pages spread out on the table in front of him, typed, but already covered in annotations added in his spidery hand. Was it too long? There had been complaints recently from some of his congregation that his sermons had dragged on a bit, and even the bishop had shown some impatience during his address on Pentecost Sunday. But this was different. Mrs. Blakiston had lived her entire life in the village. Everybody knew her. Surely they could spare half an hour, or even 40 minutes, of their time to say farewell. The kitchen was a large, cheerful room with an arger radiating a gentle warmth the whole year round. Pots and pans hung from hooks, and there were jars filled with fresh herbs and dried mushrooms that the Osbornes had picked themselves. Upstairs there were 2 bedrooms, both snug and homely with shag carpets, hand-embroidered pillowcases, and brand-new skylights that had only been added after much consultation with the church. But the main joy of the vicarage was its position on the edge of the village, looking out onto the woodland that everyone knew as Dingle Dell. There was a wild meadow speckled with flowers in the spring and summer, then a stretch of woodland whose trees, mainly oaks and elms, concealed the grounds of Pye Hall on the other side. The lake, the lawns, then the house itself. Every morning, Robin Osborne awoke to a view that could not fail to delight him. He sometimes thought he was living in a fairy tale. The vicarage hadn't always been like this. When they had inherited the house and the parish from the elderly Reverend Montague, it had been very much an old man's home, damp and unwelcoming. But Henrietta had worked her magic, throwing out all the furniture that she deemed too ugly or uncomfortable, and scouring the second-hand shops of Wiltshire and Somerset to find perfect replacements. Her energy never ceased to amaze him. That she had chosen to be a vicar's wife in the first place was surprising enough, but she had thrown herself into her duties with an enthusiasm that had made her popular from the day they had arrived. The two of them could not be happier than they were in Saxby-on-Avon. It was true that the church needed attention. The heating system was permanently on the blink. The roof had started leaking again. But their congregation was more than large enough to satisfy the bishop and many of the worshippers they now considered as friends. They wouldn't have dreamed of being anywhere else. She was part of the village. Although we are here today to mourn her departure, we should remember what she left behind. Mary made Saxby-on-Avon a better place for everyone else, whether it was arranging the flowers every Sunday in this very church, visiting the elderly both here and at Ashton House, collecting for the RSPB, or greeting visitors to Pye Hall. Her homemade cakes were always the star of the village fete, and I can tell you, there were many occasions when she would surprise me in the vestry with one of her almond bites, or perhaps a slice of Victoria sponge. Osborne tried to picture the woman who had spent most of her life working as the housekeeper at Pye Hall. Small, dark-haired, and determined, she had always been in a rush, as if on a personal crusade. His memories of her seemed mainly to be in the mid-distance, because in truth, they had never spent that much time in the same room. They had been together at 1 or 2 social occasions, perhaps, but not that many. The sort of people who lived in Saxby-on-Avon weren't outright snobs, but at the same time they were very well aware of class, and although a vicar might be deemed a suitable addition to any social gathering, the same could not be said of someone who was, at the end of the day, a cleaner. Perhaps she had been aware of this. Even at church, she had tended to take a pew at the very back. There was something quite deferential about the way she insisted on helping people, as if she somehow owed it to them. Or was it simpler than that? When he thought about her and looked at what he had just written, a single word came to mind. Busybody. It wasn't fair, and it certainly wasn't something he would ever have spoken out loud, but he had to admit there was some truth to it. She was the sort of woman who had a finger in every pie, apple and blackberry included, who had made it her business to connect with everyone in the village. Somehow she was always there when you needed her. The trouble was, she was also there when you didn't. He remembered finding her here, in this very room, just over a fortnight ago. He was annoyed with himself. He should have expected it. Henrietta was always complaining about the way he left the front door open, as if the vicarage were merely an appendage to the church, rather than their private home. He should have listened to her. Mary had shown herself in, and she was standing there, holding up a little bottle of green liquid, as if it were some medieval talisman used to ward off demons. "Good morning, Vicar. I heard you were having trouble with wasps. I brought you some peppermint oil. That'll get rid of them. My mother always used to swear by it." It was true. There had been wasps in the vicarage, but how had she known? Osborne hadn't told anyone except Henrietta, and she surely wouldn't have mentioned it. Of course, that was to be expected of a community like Saxby-on-Avon. Somehow, in some unfathomable way, everyone knew everything about everyone, and it had often been said that if you sneezed in the bath, someone would appear with a tissue. Seeing her there, Osborne hadn't been sure whether to be grateful or annoyed. He had muttered a word of thanks, but at the same time he had glanced down at the kitchen table. And there they were, just lying there in the middle of all his papers. How long had she been in the room? Had she seen them? She wasn't saying anything, and of course he didn't dare ask her. He had ushered her out as quickly as he could, and that had been the last time he had seen her. He and Henrietta had been away on holiday when she had died. They had only just returned, in time to bury her. He heard footsteps and looked up as Henrietta came into the room. She was fresh out of the bath, still wrapped in a toweling dressing gown. Now in her late 40s, she was still a very attractive woman with chestnut hair tumbling down and a figure that clothing catalogues would have described as full. She came from a very different world, the youngest daughter of a wealthy farmer with 1,000 acres in West Sussex. And yet, when the two of them had met in London, at a lecture being given at the Wigmore Hall, they had discovered an immediate affinity. They had married without the approval of her parents, and they were as close now as they had ever been. Their one regret was that their marriage had not been blessed with any children, but of course that was God's will, and they had come to accept it. They were happy simply being with each other. "I thought you'd finished with that," she said. She had taken butter and honey out of the pantry. She cut herself a slice of bread. "Just adding a few last-minute thoughts. Well, I wouldn't talk too long if I were you, Robin. It is a Saturday after all, and everyone's going to want to get on. We're gathering in the Queen's Arms afterwards at 11 o'clock. That's nice." Henrietta carried a plate with her breakfast over to the table and plumped herself down. "Did Sir Magnus ever reply to your letter?" "No, but I'm sure he'll be there." "Well, he's leaving it jolly late." She leant over and looked at one of the pages. "You can't say that." "What?" "The life and soul of any party." "Why not?" "Because she wasn't. I always found her rather buttoned up and secretive, if you want the truth. Not easy to talk to at all." "She was quite entertaining when she came here last Christmas. She joined in the carols, if that's what you mean, but you never really knew what she was thinking. I can't say I liked her very much." "You shouldn't talk about her that way, Hen. Certainly not today." "I don't see why not. That's the thing about funerals. They're completely hypocritical. Everyone says how wonderful the deceased was, how kind, how generous, when deep down they know it's not true. I didn't ever take to Mary Blakiston, and I'm not going to start singing her praises just because she managed to fall down a flight of stairs and break her neck." "You're being a little uncharitable." "I'm being honest, Robbie, and I know you think exactly the same, even if you're trying to convince yourself otherwise. But don't worry, I promise I won't disgrace you in front of the mourners." She pulled a face. "There, is that sad enough? Hadn't you better get ready? I've got it all laid out upstairs. Black dress, black hat, black pearls." She sighed. "When I die, I don't want to wear black. It's so cheerless. Promise me, I want to be buried in pink with a big bunch of begonias in my hands." "You're not going to die, not any time soon. Now go upstairs and get dressed." All right, you bully. She leant over him and he felt her breasts, soft and warm, pressing against his neck. She kissed him on the cheek, then hurried out, leaving her breakfast on the table. Robin Osborne smiled to himself as he returned to his address. Perhaps she was right. He could cut out a page or two. Once again, he looked down at what he had written. Mary Blakiston did not have an easy life. She knew personal tragedy soon after she came to Saxby-on-Avon, and she could so easily have allowed it to overwhelm her. But she fought back. She was the sort of woman who embraced life, who would never let it get the better of her. And as we lay her to rest, beside the son whom she loved so much and whom she lost so tragically, perhaps we can take some solace from the thought that they are, at last, together. Robin Osborne read the paragraph twice. Once again he saw her standing there, in this very room, right next to the table. "I heard you were having trouble with wasps." Had she seen them? Had she known? The sun must have gone behind a cloud, because suddenly there was a shadow across his face. He reached out, tore up the entire page, and dropped the pieces into the bin. Chapter 3. Dr. Emilia Redwing had woken early. She had lain in bed for an hour trying to persuade herself that she might still get back to sleep. Then she had got up, put on a dressing gown, and made herself a cup of tea. She had been sitting in the kitchen ever since, watching the sun rise over her garden, and beyond it, the ruins of Saxby Castle, a 13th-century structure which gave pleasure to the many hundreds of amateur historians who visited it, but which cut out the sunlight every afternoon, casting a long shadow over the house. It was a little after 8:30. The newspaper should have been delivered by now. She had a few patient files in front of her, and she busied herself going over them, partly to distract herself from the day ahead. The surgery was usually open on Saturday mornings, but today, because of the funeral, it would be closed. Oh well, it was a good time to catch up with her paperwork. There was never anything very serious to treat in a village like Saxby-on-Avon. If there was one thing that would carry off the residents, it was old age, and Dr. Redwing couldn't do very much about that. Going through the files, she cast a weary eye over the various ailments that had recently come her way. Miss Dotterall, who helped at the village shop, was getting over the measles after a week spent in bed. 9-year-old Billy Weaver had a nasty attack of whooping cough, but it was already behind him. His grandfather, Jeff Weaver, had arthritis, but then he'd had it for years, and it wasn't getting any better or worse. Johnny Whitehead had cut his hand. Henrietta Osborne, the vicar's wife, had managed to step on a clump of deadly nightshade, Atropa belladonna, and had somehow infected her entire foot. She had prescribed a week's bed rest and plenty of water. Other than that, the warm summer seemed to have been good for everyone's health. Not everyone's. No. There had been a death. Dr. Redwing pushed the files to one side and went over to the stove where she busied herself making breakfast for herself and her husband. She had already heard Arthur moving about upstairs, and there had been the usual grinding and rattling as he poured himself his bath. The plumbing in the house was at least 50 years old, and complained loudly every time it was pressed into service, but at least it did the job. He would be down soon. She cut the bread for toast, filled a saucepan with water, and placed it on the hob, took out the milk and the cornflakes, laid the table. Arthur and Amelia Redwing had been married for 30 years. A happy and successful marriage, she thought to herself, even if things hadn't gone quite as they had hoped. For a start, there was Sebastian, their only child, now 24 and living with his beatnik friends in London. How could he have become such a disappointment? And when exactly was it that he had turned against them? Neither of them had heard from him for months, and they couldn't even be sure if he was alive or dead. And then there was Arthur himself. He had started life as an architect, and a good one. he had been given the Soane Medallion by the Royal Institute of British Architects for a design he had completed at art school. He had worked on several of the new buildings that had sprung up immediately after the war. But his real love had been painting, mainly portraits in oils, and 10 years ago he had given up his career to work as a full-time artist. He had done so with Emilia's full support. One of his works hung in the kitchen, on the wall beside the Welsh dresser, and she glanced at it now. It was a portrait of herself, painted 10 years ago, and she always smiled when she looked at it, remembering the extended silences as she sat for him, surrounded by wild flowers. Her husband never talked when he worked. There had been a dozen sittings during a long, hot summer, and Arthur had somehow managed to capture the heat, the haze in the late afternoon, even the scent of the meadow. She was wearing a long dress with a straw hat, like a female Van Gogh, she had joked, and perhaps there was something of that artist's style in the rich colours, the jabbing brushstrokes. She was not a beautiful woman. She knew it. Her face was too severe, her broad shoulders and dark hair too masculine. There was something of the teacher, or perhaps the governess, in the way she held herself. People found her too formal. But he had found something beautiful in her. If the picture had hung in a London gallery, nobody would be able to pass it without looking twice. It didn't. It hung here. No London galleries were interested in Arthur or his work. Emilia couldn't understand it. The two of them had gone together to the summer exhibition at the Royal Academy and had looked at work by James Gunn and Sir Alfred Munnings. There had been a controversial portrait of the Queen by Simon Elwes. But it all looked very ordinary and timid compared to his work. Why did nobody recognize Arthur Redwing for the genius that he undoubtedly was? She took 3 eggs and lowered them gently into the pan. 2 for him, 1 for her. One of them cracked as it came into contact with the boiling water, and at once she thought of Mary Blakiston, with her skull split open after her fall. She couldn't avoid it. Even now she shuddered at the memory of what she had seen, and yet she wondered why that should be. It wasn't the first dead body she had encountered, and working in London during the worst of the Blitz, she had treated soldiers with terrible injuries. What had been so different about this? Perhaps it was the fact that the two of them had been close. It was true that the doctor and the housekeeper had very little in common, but they had become unlikely friends. It had started when Mrs. Blakiston was a patient. She'd suffered an attack of shingles that had lasted for a month, and Dr. Redwing had been impressed both by her stoicism and good sense. After that, she'd come to rely on her as a sounding board. She had to be careful. She couldn't breach patient confidentiality. But if there was something that troubled her, she could always rely on Mary to be a good listener and to offer sensible advice. And the end had been so sudden. An ordinary morning just over a week ago had been interrupted on the phone by Brent, the groundsman who worked at Pye Hall. "Can you come, Dr. Redwing? It's Mrs. Blakiston. She's at the bottom of the stairs in the big house. She's lying there. I think she's had a fall." "Is she moving?" "I don't think so." "Are you with her now?" "I can't get in. All the doors are locked." Brent was in his 30s, a crumpled young man with dirt beneath his fingernails and sullen indifference in his eyes. He tended the lawns and the flower beds, and occasionally chased trespassers off the land, just as his father had before him. The grounds of Pye Hall backed onto a lake, and children liked to swim there in the summer, but not if Brent was around. He was a solitary man, unmarried, living alone in the house that had once belonged to his parents. He was not much liked in the village because he was considered shifty. The truth was that he was uneducated and possibly a little autistic, but the rural community had been quick to fill in the blanks. Dr. Redwing told him to meet her at the front door, threw together a few medical supplies, and leaving her nurse-cum-receptionist, Joy, to turn away any new arrivals, hurried to her car. Pye Hall was on the other side of Dingle Dell, 15 minutes on foot and no more than a 5-minute drive. It had always been there, as long as the village itself, and although it was a mishmash of architectural styles, it was certainly the grandest house in the area. It had started life as a nunnery, but had been converted into a private home in the 16th century, then knocked around in every century since. What remained was a single elongated wing with an octagonal tower constructed much later at the far end. Most of the windows were Elizabethan, narrow and mullioned, but there were also Georgian and Victorian additions with ivy spreading all around them as if to apologize for the indiscretion. At the back, there was a courtyard and the remains of what might have been cloisters. A separate stable block was now used as a garage. But its main glory was its setting. A gate with two stone griffins marked the entrance, and a gravel drive past the lodge house where Mary Blakiston lived, then swept round in a graceful swan's neck across the lawns to the front door with its Gothic arch. There were flower beds arranged like daubs of paint on an artist's palette, and enclosed by ornamental hedges, a rose garden with, it was said, over 100 different varieties. The grass stretched all the way down to the lake with Dingledale on the other side. Indeed, the whole estate was surrounded by mature woodland, filled with bluebells in the spring, separating it from the modern world. The tires crunched on the gravel as Dr. Redwing came to a halt and saw Brent waiting nervously for her, turning his cap over in his hands. She got out, took her medicine bag, and went over to him. "Is there any sign of life?" she asked. "I haven't looked," Brent muttered. Dr. Redwing was startled. Hadn't he even tried to help the poor woman? Seeing the look on her face, he added, "I told you, I can't get in." "The front door's locked?" "Yes, ma'am. The kitchen door, too."
"Don't you have any keys?"
"No, ma'am. I don't go in the house." Dr. Redwing shook her head, exasperated. In the time she had taken to get here, Brent could have done something. Perhaps fetched a ladder to try a window upstairs.
"If you couldn't get in, how did you telephone me?" she asked.
It didn't matter, but she just wondered. "There's a phone in the stable."
"Well, you'd better show me where she is."
"You can see through the window." The window in question was at the edge of the house, one of the newer additions. It gave a side view of the hall with a wide staircase leading up to the first floor. And there, sure enough, was Mary Blakiston, lying sprawled out on a rug, one arm stretched in front of her, partly concealing her head. From the very first sight, Dr. Redwing was fairly sure that she was dead. Somehow she had fallen down the stairs and broken her neck. She wasn't moving, of course, but it was more than that. The way the body was lying was too unnatural. It had that broken doll look that Redwing had observed in her medicine books. That was her instinct. But looks could be deceptive. "We have to get in," she said. "The kitchen and the front door are locked, but there must be another way."
"We could try the boot room."
"Where is that?"
"Just along here."
Brent led her to another door at the back. This one had glass panes, and although it was also securely closed, Dr. Redwing clearly saw a bunch of keys still in the lock on the other side.
"Whose are those?" she asked.
"They must be hers."
She came to a decision. "We're going to have to break the glass."
"I don't think Sir Magnus would be too happy about that," Brent grumbled.
"Sir Magnus can take that up with me if he wants to. Now, are you going to do it, or am I?"
The groundsman wasn't happy, but he found a stone and used it to knock out one of the panes. He slipped his hand inside and turned the keys. The door opened, and they went in. Waiting for the eggs to boil, Dr. Redwing remembered the scene exactly as she had seen it. It really was like a photograph printed on her mind. They had gone through the boot room, along a corridor, and straight into the main hall, with the staircase leading up to the galleried landing. Dark wood panelling surrounded them. The walls were covered with oil paintings and hunting trophies, birds in glass cases, a deer's head, a huge fish. A suit of armour, complete with sword and shield, stood beside a door that led into the living room. The hallway was long and narrow, with the front door opposite the staircase, positioned exactly in the middle. On one side, there was a stone fireplace, big enough to walk into. On the other, two leather chairs and an antique table with a telephone. The floor was made up of flagstones, partly covered by a Persian rug. The stairs were also stone, with a wine-red carpet leading up the centre. If Mary Blakiston had tripped and come tumbling down from the landing, her death would be easily explained. There was very little to cushion a fall. While Brent waited nervously by the door, she examined the body. There was no pulse. Dr. Redwing brushed some of the dark hair away from the face to reveal brown eyes staring at the fireplace. Gently, she closed them. Mrs. Blakiston had always been in a hurry. It was impossible to escape the thought. She had quite literally flung herself down the stairs, hurrying into her own death. "We have to call the police," she said. "What?" Brent was surprised. "Has someone done something to her?" "No, of course not. It's an accident, but we still have to report it." "It was an accident. You didn't have to be a detective to work it out. The housekeeper had been hoovering. The hoover was still there, a bright red thing, almost like a toy, at the top of the stairs, stuck in the banisters. Somehow she had got tangled up in the wire. She had tripped and fallen down the stairs. There was nobody else in the house. The doors were locked. What other explanation could there be?" Just over a week later, Emilia Redwing's thoughts were interrupted by a movement at the door. Her husband had come into the room. She lifted the eggs out of the pan and gently lowered them into two china egg cups. She was relieved to see that he had dressed for the funeral. She was quite sure he would have forgotten. He had put on his dark Sunday suit, though no tie. He never wore ties. There were a few specks of paint on his shirt, but that was to be expected. Arthur and paint were inseparable. "You got up early," he said.
"I'm sorry, dear. Did I wake you?"
"No, not really. But I heard you go downstairs. Couldn't you sleep?"
"I suppose I was thinking about the funeral."
"Looks like a nice day for it. I hope that bloody vicar won't go on too long. It's always the same with Bible bashers. They're too fond of the sound of their own voice." He picked up his teaspoon and brought it crashing down onto his first egg. Crack. She remembered the conversation she'd had with Mary Blakiston just 2 days before Brent had called her to the house. Dr. Redwing had discovered something. It was quite serious, and she'd been about to go and find Arthur to ask his advice when the housekeeper had suddenly appeared as if summoned by a malignant spirit. And so she had told her instead. Somehow, during the course of a busy day, a bottle had gone missing from the surgery. The contents in the wrong hands could be highly dangerous, and it was clear that somebody must have taken it. What was she to do? Should she report it to the police? She was reluctant, because inevitably it would make her look foolish and irresponsible. Why had the dispensary been left unattended? Why hadn't the cupboard been locked? Why hadn't she noticed it before now? "Don't you worry, Dr. Redwing," Mary had said. "You leave it with me for a day or two. As a matter of fact, I may have one or two ideas." That was what she had said. At the same time, there had been a look on her face which wasn't exactly sly, but which was knowing, as if she had seen something and had been waiting to be consulted on this very matter. And now she was dead. Of course it had been an accident. Mary Blakiston hadn't had time to talk to anyone about the missing poison, and even if she had, there was no way that they could have done anything to her. She had tripped and fallen down the stairs, that was all. But as she watched her husband dipping a finger of toast into his egg, Emilia Redwing had to admit it to herself. She was really quite concerned.
Chapter 4.
"Why are we going to the funeral? We hardly even knew the woman."
Johnny Whitehead was struggling with the top button of his shirt, but no matter how hard he tried, he couldn't slot it into the hole.
The truth was that the collar simply wouldn't stretch all the way round his neck. It seemed to him that recently all his clothes had begun to shrink. Jackets that he had worn for years were suddenly tight across the shoulders, and as for trousers, he gave up and plopped himself down at the breakfast table. His wife, Gemma, slid a plate in front of him. She had cooked a complete English breakfast with 2 eggs, bacon, sausage, tomato, and fried slice, just how he liked.
"Everyone will be there," Gemma said.
"That doesn't mean we have to be."
"People will talk if we aren't, and anyway, it's good for business. Her son Robert will probably clear out the house now that she's gone, and you never know what you might find."
"Probably a lot of junk."
Johnny picked up his knife and fork and began to eat.
"But you're right, love. I suppose it can't hurt to show our faces."
Saxby-on-Avon had very few shops. Of course, there was the general store, which sold just about everything anyone could possibly need, from mops and buckets to custard powder and 6 different sorts of jam. It was quite a miracle, really, how so many different products could fit in such a tiny space. Mr. Turnstone still ran the butcher's shop round the back. It had a separate entrance and plastic strips hanging down to keep away the flies, and the fish van came every Tuesday. But if you wanted anything exotic, olive oil, or any of the Mediterranean ingredients that Elizabeth David put in her books, you would have to go into Bath. The so-called General Electric store stood on the other side of the village square, but very few people went in there, unless it was for spare light bulbs or fuses. Most of the products in the window looked dusty and out of date. There was a bookshop and a tea room that only opened during the summer months. Just off the square, and before the fire station, stood the garage, which sold a range of motor accessories, but not anything that anyone would actually want. That was about it, and it had been that way for as long as anyone could remember. And then Johnny and Gemma Whitehead had arrived from London. They had bought the old post office, which had long been empty, and turned it into an antique shop with their names written in old-fashioned lettering above the window. There were many in the village who remarked that bric-a-brac rather than antiques might be a more accurate description of the contents, but from the very start the shop had proved popular with visitors who seemed happy to browse amongst the old clocks, Toby jugs, canteens of cutlery, coins, medals, oil paintings, dolls, fountain pens, and whatever else happened to be on display. Whether anyone ever actually bought anything was another matter. But the shop had now been there for 6 years, with the Whiteheads living in the flat above. Johnny was a short, broad-shouldered man, bald-headed, and, even if he hadn't noticed it, running to fat. He liked to dress loudly, rather shabby 3-piece suits, usually with a brightly coloured tie. For the funeral, he had reluctantly pulled out a more sombre jacket and trousers in grey worsted, although, like the shirt, it fitted him badly. His wife, so thin and small that there could have been 3 of her to 1 of him, was wearing black. She was not eating a cooked breakfast. She had poured herself a cup of tea and was nibbling a triangle of toast.
"Sir Magnus and Lady Pye won't be there," Johnny muttered as an afterthought.
"Where?"
"At the funeral. They won't be back until the weekend."
"Who told you that?"
"I don't know. They were talking about it in the pub. They've gone to the south of France or somewhere. All right for some, isn't it? Anyway, people have been trying to reach them, but so far, no luck."
Johnny paused, holding up a piece of sausage. To listen to him speaking now, it would have been obvious that he had lived most of his life in the East End of London. He had a quite different accent when he was dealing with customers.
"Sir Magnus isn't going to be too happy about it," he went on. "He was very fond of Mrs. Blakiston. They were thick as thieves, them two."
"What do you mean? Are you saying he had a thing with her?"
Gemma wrinkled her nose as she considered the thing.
"Nah, it's not like that. He wouldn't dare, not with his missus on the scene. And anyway, Mary Blakiston was nothing to write home about. But she used to worship him. She thought the sun shone out of his, you know where. And she'd been his housekeeper for years and years, keeper of the keys. She cooked for him, cleaned for him, gave half her life to him. I'm sure he'd have wanted to be there for the send-off.
They could have waited for him to get back.
Her son wanted to get it over with. Can't blame him, really. The whole thing's been a bit of a shock.
The two of them sat in silence while Johnny finished his breakfast. Gemma watched him intently. She often did this. It was as if she were trying to look behind his generally placid exterior, as if she might find something he was trying to conceal.
"What was she doing here?"
she asked suddenly.
"Mary Blakiston?"
"When?"
"The Monday before she died. She was here."
"No, she wasn't."
Johnny laid down his knife and fork. He had eaten quickly and wiped the plate clean.
"Don't lie to me, Johnny. I saw her coming out of the shop."
"Oh, the shop." Johnny smiled uncomfortably. "I thought you meant I'd had her up here in the flat. That would have been a right old thing, wouldn't it?"
He paused, hoping his wife would change the subject. But as she showed no sign of doing so, he went on, choosing his words carefully.
"Yes, she did look in the shop. And I suppose that would have been the same week it happened. I can't really remember what she wanted, if you want the truth, love. I think she may have said something about a present for someone, but she didn't buy nothing. Anyway, she was only in for a minute or two."
Gemma Whitehead always knew when her husband was lying. She had actually seen Mrs. Blakiston emerging from the shop, and she had made a note of it, somehow divining that something was wrong. But she hadn't mentioned it then, and decided not to pursue the matter now. She didn't want to have an argument, certainly not when the two of them were about to set off for a funeral. As for Johnny Whitehead, despite what he had said, he remembered very well his last encounter with Mrs. Blakiston. She had indeed come into the shop, making those accusations of hers. And the worst of it was that she had the evidence to back them up. How had she found it? What had put her onto him in the first place? Of course, she hadn't told him that, but she had made herself very clear. The bitch. He would never have said as much to his wife, of course, but he couldn't be more pleased that she was dead. Chapter 5. Clarissa Pye, dressed in black from head to toe, stood examining herself in the full-length mirror at the end of the hallway. Not for the first time, she wondered if the hat with its three feathers and crumpled veil wasn't a little excessive. De trop, as they said in French. She had bought it on impulse from a second-hand shop in Bath, and had regretted it a moment later. She wanted to look her best for the funeral. The whole village would be there, and she had been invited to coffee and soft drinks afterwards at the Queen's Arms. With or without. Carefully, she removed it and laid it on the hall table. Her hair was too dark. She'd had it cut specially, and although René had done his usual excellent work, that new colourist of his had definitely let the place down. She looked ridiculous, like something off the cover of Home Chat. Well, that decided it then. She would just have to wear the hat. She took out a tube of lipstick and carefully applied it to her lips. That looked better already. It was important to make an effort. The funeral wouldn't begin for another 40 minutes, and she didn't want to be the first to arrive. How was she going to fill in the time? She went into the kitchen where the washing up from breakfast was waiting, but she didn't want to do it while she was wearing her best clothes. A book lay face down on the table. She was reading Jane Austen, Dear Jane, for the umpteenth time, but she didn't feel like that either right now. She would catch up with Emma Woodhouse and her machinations in the afternoon. The radio, perhaps? Or another cup of tea and a quick stab at the Telegraph crossword. Yes, that was what she would do. Clarissa lived in a modern house. So many of the buildings in Saxby-on-Avon were solid, Georgian constructions, made of Bath stone, with handsome porticos and gardens rising up in terraces. You didn't need to read Jane Austen. If you stepped outside, you would find yourself actually in her world. She would have much rather lived beside the main square or in Rectory Lane, which ran behind the church. There were some lovely cottages there, elegant and well-kept. 4 Winsley Terrace had been built in a hurry. It was a perfectly ordinary 2-up, 2-down with a pebble-dash front and a square of garden that was hardly worth the trouble. It was identical to its neighbours, apart from a little pond, which the previous owners had added and which was home to a pair of elderly goldfish. Upper Saxby-on-Avon and Lower Saxby-on-Avon. The difference could not have been more striking. She was in the wrong half. The house was all she had been able to afford. Briefly, she examined the small square kitchen with its net curtains, the magenta walls, the aspidistra on the windowsill, and the little wooden crucifix hanging from the Welsh dresser where she could see it at the start of every day. She glanced at the breakfast things, still laid out on the table. A single plate, one knife, one spoon, one half-empty jar of golden shred marmalade. All at once, she felt the onrush of emotions that she had grown used to over the years, but which she still had to fight with all her strength. She was lonely. She should never have come here. Her whole life was a travesty. And all because of 12 minutes. 12 minutes. She picked up the kettle and slammed it down on the hob, turning on the gas with a savage twist of her hand. It really wasn't fair. How could a person's whole life be decided for them simply because of the timing of their birth? She had never really understood it when she was a child at Pye Hall. She and Magnus were twins. They were equals, happily protected by all the wealth and privilege which surrounded them, and which the two of them would enjoy for the rest of their lives. That was what she had always thought. How could this have happened to her? She knew the answer now. Magnus himself had been the first to tell her something about an entail which was centuries old and which meant that the house, the entire estate, would go to him simply because he was the firstborn, and the title, of course, because he was male, and there was nothing anyone could do about it. She had thought he was making it up just to spite her. But she had found out soon enough. It had been a process of attrition, starting with the death of her parents in a car accident when she was in her mid-20s. The house had passed formally to Magnus, and from that moment, her status had changed. She had become a guest in her own home, and an unwanted one at that. She had been moved to a smaller room, and when Magnus had met and married Frances, this was 2 years after the war, she had been gently persuaded to move out altogether. She had spent a miserable year in London, renting a tiny flat in Bayswater and watching her savings run out. In the end, she had become a governess. What choice was there for a single woman who spoke passable French, who played the piano, and who could recite works of all the major poets, but who had no other discernible skills? In a spirit of adventure, she had gone to America, first to Boston, then to Washington. Both the families she had worked for had been quite ghastly, and of course they had treated her like dirt, even though she was in every respect more experienced and, although she would never have said it herself, more refined. And the children. It was clear to her that American children were the worst in the world, with no manners, no breeding, and very little intelligence. She had, however, been well paid, and she had saved every penny, every cent that she had earned, and when she could stand it no more, after 10 long years, she had returned home. Home was Saxby-on-Avon. In a way, it was the last place she wanted to be, but it was where she had been born and where she had been brought up. Where else could she go? Did she want to spend the rest of her life in a bedsit in Bayswater? Fortunately, a job had come up at the local school, and with all the money she had saved, she had just about been able to afford a mortgage. Magnus hadn't helped her, of course. Not that she would have dreamed of asking. At first, it had galled her, seeing him driving in and out of the big house where the two of them had once played. She still had a key, her own key, to the front door. She had never returned it and never would. The key was a symbol of everything she had lost, but at the same time, it reminded her that she had every right to stay. Her presence here was almost certainly a source of embarrassment for her brother. There was some solace in that. Bitterness and anger swept through Clarissa Pye as she stood on her own in her kitchen,